I'm so surprised to see so many people here. I said to Joshin Sensei this morning, seven or eight people. Nobody's going to go out in this cold. So I guess this means it's warmed up out there, I hope. It's lovely to see so many people here. Wanting to practice the Dharma on what used to be a common winter day in New York, but now we're not used to it, and so it's kind of shocking. You know, today is the 50th day of our 90-day intensive period. We do that twice a year. We intensify our practice. Oh, let's pay attention and let's add a little bit more sitting and put some intentionality between some of our activities. So we're right in the midst of that 90-day period. We call it our urban Ango. Ango means peaceful dwelling and is the name that we use. It's a Japanese name for this period of time. And usually, in fact, almost entirely, Angos have been practiced in monastic settings. And we are one of the first groups to initiate using it in just our ordinary daily lives in an urban environment. So that we can use the grit of family and jobs and community to help us to practice, to inform our practice. So it's a focus on our intention, and it's a focus on our learning something new about the Dharma, studying something that will teach us something new and help us to excavate a new pathway for our practice. And how we are internally and externally, how we are within ourselves, watching ourselves, and how we are with others in the world. So our practice leader is not here today, our Shuso. Her name is Fusho. And she's an artist who works in film and drama and journalism. And so one thing that's important to her in her life as a filmmaker and director is the ever-present sexism in the industry. It's something she's come up against. And she sees it as particularly revealing itself in terms of ways of funding in the arts and so forth, and selection of works to be produced. So considering that reality, she and I decided to have as our study text this Ango, The Hidden Lamp, which is an anthology of stories about Buddhist women. And most of those stories have rarely been told. There's really not a lot of material out there, and so it's wonderful that there has been a book. And the name of the book is The Hidden Lamp. So hidden, that which is not seen. And lamp, that which sheds light. So I'm hoping the stories I tell you today will shed a little light for you on the past inequalities and the past insight into the Dharma that has always been there, but many of us didn't know about it. So the funny thing is that you know, through the years, we have many people who give Dharma talks. And very seldom, even though we have a lot of koans to work from, but very seldom do we repeat the koan that somebody had just given the other day. But since we've started the hidden lamp. This has happened several times during the year-end retreat. Shinryu and I both prepared a talk on one particular woman ancestor, and then I was talking with Sensei Joshin, and she was saying, "Oh no, I just heard that Shinryu is given a talk on exactly the koan I've prepared." And I said, "Oh, don't worry about that." And then yesterday when I was here, I saw Ryotan give a talk on the koans that I wanted to present today. So isn't that... So what is that, you know? Is it that there are just certain things that that trigger us, because there's you know, over 100 koans in this book. But I decided to stick with the one that I wanted to talk about, which is Sacho-jo, because none of us ever see a koan exactly the same, or a story. We tell a story, and you hear one thing, and I hear something completely different from it, and learn something from it, which is why art is such an amazing thing, because the stories that we hear help to form who we are. It's just marvelous. So I want to talk about Sacho-jo, who was a Zen Buddhist laywoman. And she practiced with the very, very famous Hakuin in 18th century Japan. She was born... he was born in 1680. Of course, we don't have her dates. Right, we have his dates, but we don't have her dates. He was born in 1686 and lived to 1768. So that was that period of time in Japan. But it's not surprising that we don't have dates for Sacho-jo, because women's lives were not valued at that time, not enough to even note them down. And I just want to pause here for a moment, because, of course, there are many people whose lives are not valued now. And that is something that is now becoming, finally, a part of public dialogue, of public speech. People, because of their color or their disability, because of their gender, because of their sexual preference, immigrants and veterans, people whose lives are not counted. It's so important for us to recognize that. You know, I just noticed the New York Times has started doing this wonderful thing. Quite often it's publishing photographs that it has never published before, that it has in the archives, of people of color. Oh, is this a word from our sponsor? people of color, women, people of disability. So check, if you happen to use the New York Times as a source of information, they're publishing these marvelous photographs, particularly many from the civil rights era that have never been seen before, that they've never published, that are now getting some viewing and some recognition of these people and what they were doing. So the only reason we know anything about this woman, Sacho-jo, is because Hakuin, the great Zen master, did value her very much and wrote about her in his journal, in his personal journal that he kept. And it's only because of that that we have any sense that she even existed. So his journal published, which is called Thicket and Briar, he says that she was his second cousin and considerably younger than him. So some people say it's his niece, but he says in his thing that he was second cousin. So that would be cousin once removed. And it seems that she had strong insight into the Dharma from the time she was very young, and that Hakuin verified that when she was a very young woman, like 9 or 10 years old. She just had a vision of the Dharma, an understanding. And you know, she never became a nun. I think that's so significant for those of us sitting here. Instead, she was a laywoman that he said vanquished others in the Dharma combat, including on occasion myself. Isn't that marvelous? So the story I want to tell, the first koan I want to tell is, you know, I'm calling it koan, calling it story, because that's what all the koans are. They're stories from which we can glean some light. And this one is about when she was 16 years old. Her parents were concerned that she couldn't find a husband. They thought she was a little plain-looking and might not find a husband, which was the only, other than becoming a nun, the only thing a young woman could do. And so they told her to pray to Kannon so that she could find a husband, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And she did that night and day. And through that practice of intense focus and intentionality on compassion, that was when she really had another deep awakening. And so one day her father comes into the room and he sees her and she's sitting on the Lotus Sutra. Now the Lotus Sutra is the most holy, you know, in East Asia, the most holy document that there is. And so she's sitting on it. And he screams, "What are you doing sitting on the Lotus Sutra?" And she responds, "How is this wonderful sutra different from my ass?" Huh? How is this wonderful sutra different from my ass? This sounds very, very unconventional, huh? At the least. So she grew up in her family. They were very devout that they would tell her to pray, you know. And I think that's an important part of the story, is that she came from a family of very devout practitioners. The environment that we create for ourselves and our loved ones is very important. I have to really remember that and consider that. It's, you know, we live in such an individualistic society where we just think, we're only thinking of ourselves all the time, but it's so important that we create an atmosphere of Dharma, an atmosphere of clarity. And that's what a devout family is, and that's what a devout community is, and that's what a Sangha is. Like, that's all of us today are kind of telling one another, it's really important, even on a very cold day, to come together and consider the Dharma, consider the teachings of how to live a meaningful life. But I think it's really important that she came from that source. And to practice the Dharma, you know, we can get so carried away with the language of practicing the Dharma like it's some kind of special thing. But actually, it can be in every act that you do, in every gesture that you make, every facial expression that you offer the world, every thought that you have. It is not some sort of esoteric thing to practice the Dharma. It is who you are. And this is what she seems to know here. So then it says, they were afraid she wouldn't find a husband. Just imagine those times when that was the only option other than becoming a nun, who couldn't consider being a person. And then it says that she needed to, they wanted her to pray for that. And I just thought, it's interesting for us every once in a while, someone asks the question, do Buddhists pray or do Zen people pray? And, you know, we always think of praying as a Judeo-Christian or Abrahamic tradition. But actually, what's in a word like pray? What are we doing when we're sitting facing the wall? We're not asking for anything. We're being present. And I would say that that is a very deep form of prayer. I am here. I am here with all the thoughts coming in and out. I am here with all that there is. That would be prayer, a different kind. What are you doing sitting on this precious scripture? What's the implication of that? The sutra is a holy thing to be revered. And her ass is an ordinary thing, a dirty thing that spoils the teachings, the spiritual truth of the Lotus Sutra. So this is why her answer is just, we love so much. How is this wonderful sutra different from my ass? Is there anything that's separate from the Dharma? You know, that's the sickness of all spiritual traditions, this separating the spiritual from the ordinary. And I must say that that is what drew me personally as a young woman to the Dharma, was seeing the simplicity and ordinariness of the Zen tradition that emphasizes the depth of the spiritual in the most ordinary of acts, in how we bow, how we prepare a meal, how we do our work in ordinary life. You know, years before this, the Vimalakirti Sutra is a sutra that very much influenced the Zen tradition. And one of my favorite passages in there is when Vimalakirti, who's the great lay teacher, lay bodhisattva, lectures Shariputra. Shariputra is kind of like a dogmatic, monastic, and likes to get things right. And Vimalakirti lectures him on meditation in the midst of daily life and how they're not to. He says, ah, Shariputra, not rising out of your samadhi of complete cessation and yet showing yourself in the ceremonies of daily life. This is true sitting. Not abandoning the principles of the way, and yet showing yourself in the activities of the common people. This is true sitting. And this is the clincher. Entering nirvana without having put an end to earthly desires. This is true sitting. So not cutting anything off, allowing it all to be present. And this is what Satchajo is teaching us here. We're not separate from everything, and that attempt to create that separation is what allows dogmatism, insensitivity, a lack of empathy and compassion to arise. It's that very idea that sacred is opposed to secular. It misunderstands the Dharma, and it misunderstands reality just as it is. So what makes this koan meaningful for me is that it's true. And it's a woman making the point in medieval Japan. The woman, in this book, The Hidden Lamp, that we're using, there's the koan, and then there's a commentary by a contemporary woman teacher. Joshin Sensei has a commentary in the book, and I do. And the woman who wrote this commentary is a teacher, a lay teacher by the name of Rachel Mansfield Howlett. And she pointed out how certain parts of our bodies, like our butts, are considered impure. Now, isn't that interesting, huh? I mean, really. They're so charming, the little butts, little asses, you know? You know, you see a little baby's ass, you can't stop. So sweet. But when we realize that that's an idea that we've inherited, some conditioning that we've inherited, when we realize that, then we can be free, you know? And she uses the example, of all things, of Rosa Parks, who put her butt down on a bus seat, huh? And became, and thus she started a movement. So I like to think of it as that part of me, or that I could think of as the most impure, or the most broken. Maybe some history that I have that I'm not going to share with you today. some lack that I might have is actually the gift, the offering that I can offer others, that you can offer others. The very thing you think is the most impure and sucky part of you is the gift. If you could turn it and see it and appreciate it and allow it to evoke empathy and compassion for yourself first, and then for what you think is not you, but which is also you, the other. So I just have a couple of minutes. I want to give another little story about Sasha Jo. When she was old, she lost her granddaughter. Her granddaughter died very young. And Sasha Jo was deeply grieving. And she was crying. And an old man from the neighborhood said, "Why are you wailing so much? If people hear this, they'll all say, why, that old lady once studied with Hakuin and was enlightened, but now she's mourning her granddaughter." Sasha Jo looked at him and scolded him. "You bald-headed old fool, what do you know? My tears and weeping are better for my granddaughter than incense, flowers, and lamps." She was old then. Many years had passed. She had had a family. She was widowed. Was deeply respected in her community. But you know what? She didn't try to just live up to some ideals of respect, but she allowed herself to be intimate with herself at all times. And in that moment of grief, God bless her, she was wailing and screaming because she was suffering. She was beautiful. And this sense of the humanness of feeling pain, you know, and this, again, this idea that the Dharma is something separate from our humanity is what blocks us from real compassion, real opening. My tears and weeping are human, not the formal ceremonies, but the heart. And Susan Moon, who wrote the commentary on this, raises the point, which is really critical for us, because we tend to just believe, oh, well, I shouldn't feel anything, or to be completely nuts, it says, the difference between losing herself in grief on the one hand and feeling deep grief on the other. So in her commentary, Susan Moon tells us about the story of two women disciples. I think you all know the story of Kisa Gotami, but also there's the story of Patakara. Both of the women were crazed with grief on the loss of their children. Both of these women lost young babies. And when Patakara came to the Buddha's camp, she was naked, dirty, and sobbing. She was completely overwhelmed with her grief. And what Shakyamuni said to her, it is said, "Sister, recover your presence of mind." What is that presence of mind? It's in that moment she stopped, saw herself, that she had completely lost herself in her grief. You know, all of us lose our presence of mind in small ways in just our ordinary lives. We get caught up one particular way of seeing the situation. We become angry because we can only see our part. How is it to recover our presence of mind, to stop blaming ourselves or stop blaming the other? To be completely here with your own breath, with your own presence, not listening to the chatter of conditioning. To be new in the moment is to be present with your mind. Patakara, when she heard those words of Shakyamuni, washed herself, put on a robe, and eventually became a teacher in that community of nuns. Her famous enlightenment poem reads this way: "I held back my mind as one would do with a thoroughbred horse. And I took a lamp and I went into the hut. First I looked at the bed, then I sat on the couch. I used a needle to pull out the lamp's wick. Just as the lamp went out, my mind was free." Held back my mind as one would do with a thoroughbred horse. So she didn't stop the horse, you just hold it back. You ever ridden a very spirited horse, you know, and the way they hold the bit and the way their bodies are ready? And to hold that just as your mind, just in that kind of way. Yes, there's readiness. There's also patience and awareness of just this moment. And then she takes a lamp, which is giving light, and goes into this dark place. Just as she's ready to pull out the wick of the lamp, it grows dark. And there are no constructions, there are no words. There's just that moment from light to dark, from everything to nothing, to emptiness. And what's there in emptiness? Everything. Everything right there. You know, if we can't do this, when we begin to feel overwhelmed by grief, fear, anger, to recover our presence of mind, is to allow the grief and the anger, but not to be ruled by it. To allow, but not be overcome. Buddha nature and my nature are not two. They look like they're two, but they're not two. You know, each year we have a monthly study group here, and our monthly study group has already started for this year. But I couldn't help noticing that this year we chose something more like the butt. Something that wasn't as dharmic as usual. We chose the impure, troublesome reality of life these days here. We wanted to look at inequality and the way we create another around issues of race, gender, different kinds of ability. And I have never heard so many people express such trepidation and fear and concern about a year-long class as opposed to doing one on the precepts or doing one on the paramitas or something officially dharmic. But when we chose something that a little bit more in the nether regions, there was resistance. Finally, the registration filled up and everyone stepped forward. But I just thought that was very interesting because it was the first year that I had experienced that with our year-long classes. I think it's because, you know, we want to separate our dharma from ordinary lives that we live. So that's why I wanted to talk about Satyajo today. Because I think women throughout space and time have always been the ones to clean the diapers, to wash the dirty dishes, and have been more aware of the integral relationship between the butt and the Lotus Sutra. So this integration is so important for us to recognize. And this time in this country, well, also in Europe, you see it, but particularly in this country, this kind of coming to consciousness of some of the really, really unequal and unfair aspects of this society. It's a really important time for us to recognize we have to look at these things in order to help ourselves and to help others, in order to serve the Dharma in our ordinary lives. They're not separate. We have to pay attention. So let me offer an encouraging gatha for you. To be alive in this world today, in this world of delight and suffering, what part do you play? Who are you? Is there an other? Or are you the other? So many masks. Wake up. We're not one, and we're not two.